Now we will focus on most realistic among those cosmological moments, which are also therefore idealized of course, but still a very topic. And those models are the Friedmann-Lemaître models, which are assuming that space is spatially fully isotropic and homogeneous. So we have the isotropy subgroup being the full rotation group and the surfaces of homogeneity being the entire space spent by translation. I can get to that in more detail. So what is the experimental evidence that allows us to choose among all those cosmological models that we studied last time? Well, the main evidence is that the universe is and has been expanding. This finding is now 80 years old. In 1929, Hubble and Humason discovered that the universe is and has been expanding by looking at galaxies outside our own and noticing that the further away a galaxy is, the redder it is. So they saw the redshift, and Hubble then plotted a linear relationship between distance and redshift. And that was very soon interpreted as indicating an expansion space. Hubble is not really the first to point this out. There were some folks earlier than him. But what Hubble really should be famous about is that he discovered that our galaxy is not the only. Up until Hubble, apparently, it was thought that all the stars that we can see are just from our own galaxy, and that is it. The universe is our galaxy. And it's still true that all the stars that we see individually are part of our own galaxy. We can't, at least not with the naked eye, see individual stars in other galaxies. So Hubble was the first to notice, hey, there are other galaxies around. For example, the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest neighbor, is actually visible with the naked eye. It just wasn't understood at the time that this is another galaxy. Anyway, by 1929, it was clear that everything is moving away from everything, and that this can be interpreted as solid evidence for the expansion of the universe. More than that, now we know that the universe is pretty homogeneous and isotropic. Of course, it's pretty grainy on short scale. There's a galaxy here, there's no galaxy there, and therefore there's a lot of matter here, less matter over there. And also, there are clusters of galaxies, and there are clusters of galaxies. But once you average over distances of about 2, 3, 4 billion light years, it seems that everything is pretty small. There are no further big bumps or holes in the universe. So once you smooth out over that sort of length scale, the universe is, once you look at that sort of length scale, the universe is pretty much spatially isotropic and homogeneous. And that means that we can start with this assumption of spatial full isotropy and spatial full homogeneity, and then see what how we can solve the Einstein equations, assuming that symmetry. What we end up with when we do that is the Friedmann-Lemaître model. And we will explicitly do this today, solve the Einstein equation under those assumptions of symmetry. Let's start with that. From the experimental evidence, motivated, we will model now space-time as a manifold, MG, which is of the form of a piece of the real line, which will be the time variable, cross some spatial manifold. That's not necessarily always possible. Space-time as a four-dimensional manifold might be something much more complicated than just the piece and product between a line or a piece of a line and some spatial manifold. It could be four-dimensionally complicated with holes and handles, But our assumption is it's not. It's simply the Cartesian product between piece of the real line or the entire real line itself and some spatial manifold. And by spatial manifold, I mean Riemann manifold. The whole thing is going to be a Lorentzian manifold, so it's metric, it's not positive. But this piece is assumed to have a Riemann manifold. So we assume that the metric can be written as minus dp squared plus some scale factor times.
So
we assume that the metric can be written in this way, plus what we call a scale factor times a metric restricted to just that manifold here. This is when we use for the metric the when we express the metric in a basis that comes with a choice of coordinates. Of course, later on we will choose a tetrad, in which case the metric will be just the Minkowski metric, and all the information about the non-triviality and the curvature of space-time will be encoded in the relationship between a canonical basis and a tetrad basis. Now, I is going to be an interval, some subset of the real line in which the time variable lives, and we will call that the cosmic time. A of t, as I said, is going to be called the scale factor. So, keep in mind that even though this is a fixed differential manifold, for example, R3, it doesn't mean that we can't describe
expansion. We can describe expansion because the metric is allowed to be fully extended. This is just a differential manifold. It has no notion of size. Differential manifolds have notions of connectivity, differentiability, but there is no notion of distance between points on what is just a differential manifold. The notion of distance between points only makes sense once you have implemented metric on the differential manifold. And that metric has this general form, and that means that distances can change over time. Now, our assumption is motivated by the fact that space-time over length scales of a few billion light years is very homogeneous and isotropic. We will assume that this differentiable manifold sigma is equipped with a Riemannian metric d bar, so the bar will always indicate that it is just spatial. So this differential manifold equipped with this Riemannian metric is assumed to be fully isotropic and homogeneous. In particular, it's a Riemannian manifold, not a fuller one. Now, since it is to be fully isotropic and homogeneous, the curvature is assumed to be not varying. The curvature does not depend on the direction you look at, and it doesn't depend on where you look. So this manifold, by assumption, is a manifold of constant curvature, thereby providing, as we said, three-dimensional surfaces of homogeneity, and also full isotropy subfield. But the fact that the curvature is assumed to be constant doesn't mean that the curvature is assumed to be zero. What possibilities are there? What sort of Riemannian manifolds are there which have constant curvature? Well, the Riemann tensor for a Riemannian manifold, so remember this is just the spatial part that we're talking about just now, just sigma. And we put therefore a bar over R. So those indices really run only from 1 to 3, not from 0 to 3. The Riemann tensor must be expressible in terms of the tensors of the theory. But the theory is completely symmetric in this case, and there are not many symmetric, not many non-trivial tensors around. In fact, there's only the metric. So the Riemann tensor has to be expressible in terms of the metric somehow. Now, given the index symmetry of the Riemann curvature tensor, namely that we have symmetry with respect to interchanging ij with kdl, and we have an anti-symmetry with respect to interchanging ij and with respect to interchanging kl, we can conclude that R bar, the Riemann curvature tensor on just the spatial part, on sigma, has to be of this general form. There just isn't any other combination that we can write down in terms of G that would have that symmetry structure. And we simply don't have any other tensors around other than the metric that could possibly come into this. So therefore, we can shortcut a lengthy calculation and just come quickly to the conclusion that the Riemann curvature tensor might take that form. And that particular constant here in front is indeterminate. It could take any arbitrary value. It could be zero, in which case we have this fully symmetric spatial manifold, which is completely flat because it has no curvature whatsoever. But it could also have positive or negative values of k. Now, once we have the Riemann curvature tensor, we can, of course, also calculate what the Ricci tensor is by just contracting two of its indices, two right indices, of course. And when we do that, we find that the contraction, when applied to the metric, means that the Ricci tensor, you know, the thing that enters into the Einstein equation, for example, that the Ricci tensor simply reduces to 2 times k the metric tensor. Isn't that nice? The Ricci tensor, which, by the way, has the metric indices of it, is simply proportional to the metric. It's, remember, it's just a special circumstance when you have full isotropy and full homogeneity. In general, you wouldn't have anything as simple as that. And if you contract those two indices, then you obtain that the Ricci scalar is 6k. Where does this extra factor of 3 come from? Well, it's because you trace it for that. And there are 3 terms in the trace. The 3 terms are the same. So now that we know what the Riemann curvature tensor is on the spatial manifold, we can calculate the Ricci tensor, we can calculate the Riemann scalar, and also we can use our formalism of tensor valued forms and choose a triad, that is an orthonormal basis of vectors in the cotangent space. But this is just a basis in the spatial part of the cotangent space. That's why there's a bar over those, and there are only 3 basis vectors. See, a tetrad would be the term for 4 dimensions, tetras in 4 and 3. And a triad is 3 of those in the spatial case. So in the tetrad formalism, if you remember, this is the definition of the curvature 2 form. Curvature is a 1-1 tensor valued 2 form. And by definition, it was this expression. We now have this explicitly as the metric. And we can work out what it is, therefore, by plugging that expression into here, using the fact that this is anti-symmetric, and then we get that those two terms, because of the anti-symmetry, we get that one of those changes the sign, and the two are additive, this one half goes away, and we obtain the curvature 2 form in this simple, we obtain this simple expression for the curvature 2 form. Simply k times the best product of those basis vectors. Now keep in mind, this is the curvature tensor just for the spatial part of the space-time manifold. And these are only, there are only 3 of those theta bars. Of course, eventually we'll have to lift the whole thing into this 3+1 dimensional thing. Now what cases are there? Obviously 3 cases. K could be larger, smaller, or equal to 0. Now, if k is larger than 0, then, oh, by the way, maybe I should make that comment here too. A similar analysis could be done, of course, for four dimensions. Everything we just said, this whole thing here, with the metric and so on, that could be carried through also in four dimensions. And it could be carried through for the four-dimensional Lorentzian signature case, so really for the case of space-time. So we could, in principle, at least mathematically, even if it's not experimentally motivated, we could require, we could look at space-times that have full isotropy in space and time, and full homogeneity in space and time. We can run through this thing, and what we end up with is the so-called physical spaces. Anyway, we're still in the spatial case here. And in the spatial case, if the parameter k is larger than 0, of course, that's to be decided experimentally, what sort of space-time we have. If k is larger than 0, then sigma is a three-dimensional sphere. For example, it could be embedded in a four-dimensional, it could be embedded, for example, in R4. That would be a closed universe. If you travel in one direction, you come back from there. Okay. And of course, in any direction, you would come back from the opposite direction, just like if you're traveling on the surface of the sphere. The sphere would be two-dimensional, fully symmetric, fully rotational symmetric, fully homogeneously symmetric, right? Translation, rotation, invariant. And no matter which direction you travel, if you go on straight, you come back to where you started. But the sphere is only two-dimensional. This would be the case of space, of three-dimensional space being just like that, having a positive curvature. You just travel in any arbitrary direction. Eventually, you come back to where you started. So in principle, you can see you're back. Not bright enough.
Time?
Yes.
A sigma is a space like hypersurface?
Yes, that's right.
So k equal to 0
would be the case without curvature, in which case the spatial sigma is simply Euclidean R3. It's a flat universe, flat meaning curvature equal to 0, and it's infinite in extent. In this case over here, it would be would have a finite volume, which could be tremendously large, but it would be finite. In this case, the volume is infinite. Now, if k is smaller than 0, then we obtain a so-called pseudosphere. Sigma is still three-dimensional, but because of this constant negative curvature, it would have what is called a hyperbolic shape. It would be everywhere like a saddle. You know, a saddle would be in one direction it goes like that, in the other direction it goes like this. In this case, you could travel forever in one direction, never come back, and nothing would ever repeat itself if you go on. Such manifolds would have infinite volume. Curvature tensor, and by this I don't mean just the Ricci scale. The full curvature tensor has units of 1/length squared. To see this, just remember, for example, the expression of the curvature tensor in terms of the Christofferson, where you would go up to second derivatives in space, which means 1/length squared. So the Riemann curvature tensor has units of 1/length squared. Doesn't matter that it's 1/length squared, it could be 1/10^27. The point is it has units. And therefore, the amount of the magnitude of k depends on the units that you choose, on your reference length. You could either change your reference length from meters to centimeters to inches or not, and that would change the value of k. Or, in the case of an expanding universe, you can choose the preference length at different times. If things are expanding, that corresponds to different lengths at different times. So by choosing your reference length appropriately, you can change the value of k whichever way you like. You cannot change its character. If it's positive, it will be positive no matter what units you choose. If it's negative, it will be negative no matter what units you choose, and zero remains zero. But the point is, you can rescale this thing by choosing appropriately your reference length and when you choose your reference. And it has become customary to choose that reference length and the time when you choose it by convention, always such that k comes out to be either +1, -1, or 0. But in principle, if you just choose any odd unit, k has no reason to be +1, -1, or 0. So without restricting generality, we can assume that we are dealing with those three cases. And now later, of course, we will have to find out what the universe is like. Was this curvature, negative curvature, or no curvature? Are you all informed about this? Do you know what the universe is like? Any guesses? Against it?
Right. It's quite amazing that the evidence is that the curvature of space-time is extremely small. Extremely small. We have no positive evidence for curvature. I mean, of course, we have positive evidence for curvature nearby. I mean, that's why the Earth is going around the sun. But the point is that on length scales larger than 2 or 3 billion light years, we have no evidence for any curvature. And this is extremely amazing because this is not a stable point under the evolution. Under the evolution due to the Einstein equation, as we will see today, if the universe is close to zero now, close to no curvature now, it must have been extremely much closer to no curvature in the past. Because even the smallest amount of curvature, through the evolution, because of the Einstein equations, would blow up very quickly to large amounts of curvature. So if 13.7 billion years into the evolution of the universe, we are still very, very close to k equals zero. It means that we must have started out with k very close to zero very, very early on. Much closer than is than could be by chance. We will address that problem today and also how we solve it.
Well, better do it today because the last session.
Okay. And we have a tremendous program today. Not to be done. Okay, so now let's bring together what we did all along this term and use, for example, the tetrad formalism to solve the Einstein equations for to actually get the explicit cosmological solution. We could do it, of course, also in explicitly in coordinates and so on, but just as an exercise, let's do it this way. First, we define a convenient tetrad, which is to say we choose an orthonormal basis for each of the tangent spaces. And for that purpose, we will choose as a basis vector in, and this is now a tetrad, not a triad, so this is space and time. We're looking for 4 basis vectors. When we choose for those 4 basis vectors, theta 0 and theta no bar, that is for space-time, but this thing lives in a 4-dimensional potential space. And we choose for that dt, which is the one that comes from the coordinate system. And then we choose for the theta I, the up to the scale factor, a of t, the theta bar I that we had just for the spatial manifold. Remember this thing that theta naught is directly dt, but theta I is the scale factor times theta bar I. In this way, as you're invited to check, with the given metric, which has factors of A in the spatial parts, remember how the metric looked like? Here we go. This is the metric. And the inverse metric would have inverse a squared, would have a to the power minus 2. So with that metric, we have that those guys are also normal. It's like that. And you see that this is therefore not a choice. We have to put that in there so that those guys form an orthonormal basis, not just an orthogonal, but orthonormal basis. Okay, so the theta bar I are now chosen orthonormal with respect to, were chosen orthonormal with respect to the to the spatial metric G bar, and the theta I are orthonormal with respect to the full spacetime metric G. Then, once we have a tetrad, we can write down Bianchi identities, and in particular, we can also write down the structure equations. Remember that there were two Bianchi identities, and the Bianchi identities expressed, I hope you remember that, something about the internal consistency conditions of the mathematical theory, such as the homogeneous Maxwell equation. Or in general relativity, the fact that you can choose whatever coordinate system you like. And ultimately, the Bianchi identities were reducing to things like a Jacobi identity for not deep physically, but useful mathematically. Now, the structure equations are of a different kind, and I hope you remember what they are about. There are two structure equations. The first structure equation expresses, or Cartan structure equation, first structure equation expresses the torsion to form in terms of the connection one form. And the second structure equation expresses the curvature to form in terms of the connection one form. So at the moment we will need only the first structure equation. But we need it twice. We will have one structure equation for the spatial manifold only, and we will have another structure, another first structure equation for the full spacetime. Now, as I said, the first structure equation expresses the torsion, or the torsion two form in terms of the connection one form. Namely, the first structure equation, fully spelled out, would say that this expression here, in terms of the connection one form, is equal to the torsion two form. But the torsion is vanishing, so therefore the first structure equation is this. And remember, to remind you, the second structure equation would say that the curvature two form is d omega plus omega beta. It is to express the curvature in terms of the connection one form. Remember, you probably remember from the first course in general relativity that the curvature tensor can be expressed in terms of the Christoffel symbol. That is what the second structure equation is doing, expressing the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form, curvature two form standing, carrying all the information of the curvature tensor, and the connection one form carrying all the information of the Christoffel symbol. And similarly, there is in initial canonic coordinating expressions related to torsion to the Christoffel symbols in the as I mentioned part. And this is what is expressed in the first structure equation. Anyway, the first structure equation on just the spatial part of the manifold looks like this. And I assume it to sigma 1, saying that this is the first structure equation on just sigma. And here we have the first structure equation on the full spacetime manifold. In both cases, simply expressing no torsion on the spatial part, no torsion on the spacetime as a whole. So here the indices run only from 1 to 3, here the indices run from 0 to 4, from 0 to 3. Okay, our aim now is to find out more about this connection, about the connection one force, about this connection in the four-dimensional space-time. See, what we have is those guys. What now is the connection? You see, in principle, we should be able to calculate everything, because we have here a relationship between a tetrad and a canonical basis. Well, those guys can also be expressed in terms of canonical basis. Therefore, it should be possible. Therefore, we can diagonalize the metric. But if we know how to diagonalize the metric, we know the metric. And remember, we did this calculation. And therefore, we should be able to calculate everything, including the affine connection, including the connection one form. So let us calculate that thing. You would have to calculate much more than that. You would have to calculate the Riemann curvature tensor, for example, eventually, and then in terms of those thetas. And once we have that, then we can put that into the Einstein equation and solve it. So this is the start of that program. At the end, we want to solve the Einstein equation. All right. So in order to get hold of those connection one forms, we follow the following strategy. First of all, we express the d theta I in two ways. Once we say that d theta I is d of a theta bar I. See, this is a spatial basis vector, but in the full space time, it doesn't have a bar. We can express that in terms of the triad basis vector theta bar I if we add this scale factor in front. Remember that was, we had this relation that the theta I is a times theta bar. Okay, but if we do that, then we can use the auxiliary derivative on both to get d a veg theta bar I plus I d theta bar I. Now, we can write this in the following way. We can write dA by dt, dt, veg theta I. That's just this thing. I just used the chain rule in this. And here we're using the first structure equation, and that is the structure equation for the spatial part. So we're using this one. So d theta bar, which is what we have over here, d theta bar is minus omega bar wedge theta bar. So minus omega bar wedge theta bar, and this a carries forward from here. Okay, so there. So the general strategy is we use the spatial structure equation here, and then we use the space-time structure equation over there, compare the two, and obtain this result here. All right, so we have here now dA by dt, dt, but dt is directly a fringe vector. So we have this expression, dA dot means time derivative of A. And in general, what thing that we follow is the dot will always denote the time derivative. Minus that, it's simply carried forward. So using the spatial part of the spatial structure equation, we can write d theta I in this way. On the other hand, we can also look at d theta I and employ directly the space-time structure equation, namely that d theta I is minus the space-time omega which that, and we obtain that d theta I is minus omega which theta. And this fits into two terms. See, this is sum of all nu. But nu, the Greek indices, will always stand, or always standing, for space-time indices. So nu runs from 0 to 3. We can write, therefore, this sum of four terms as the term in which we sum the 0 component and the three terms in which we sum the spatial component. And we use the Latin indices to denote spatial indices that run only from 1 to 3. Now we can compare this expression for d theta I with that expression for d theta I. And then we can read off that this thing better match to that. And then, since this thing has to match over here, we can identify that omega I naught has to be this piece, that we have here, and we can identify that omega ij is the same as, in fact, the spatial only omega ij. So the affine connection, the purely spatial affine connection is, in fact, the same as the spatial components of the space-time affine. Those two equations in the box, we will later refer to again, and therefore let's give them a name, let's call them box. Okay, just to give them a name. Also, we can show that omega naught naught, which we have not covered here, you see we have omega ij for all I and j line from 1 to 3. We also have the omega with a zero component and some spatial components, and what we don't have in this is omega 0, 0. But omega 0, 0 is vanishing, and it's just a little calculation that shows that. Remember that G is omega mu nu plus omega mu nu, but we are working in a tetrad frame here, and therefore the metric is a constant. It's just a Minkowski metric in our choice of basis, which means that this is zero, which means that the omega mu nu is anti-symmetric, and therefore actually everything on the diagonal is vanishing. So the omega mu naught in particular is vanishing. Now we are ready to get to the curvature 2 form, and once we have that, we are closer to solving that. Remember the second structure equation. The second structure equation expresses not the torsion in terms of the affine connection, it expresses the curvature in terms of the affine. So here we have the curvature on space-time expressed in terms of the connection 1 form, and here we have the curvature on space only expressed in terms of the connection 1 form for space only. Again, we use both to draw our conclusions. We start out with the Riemann curvature tensor in space-time. It doesn't have a bar on it, but we're looking only at the spatial components.
We're using the second structure equation on space-time, so this one, and here we go, that's just that. Now we use what we learned and put up there in the box, in the what omega I zero is in terms of theta, and the fact that omega is in omega bar, so the spatial component. So we know that for the spatial component, omega is the omega bar, that gives us what is here. And from here to here, as far as the summation of the spatial indices is concerned, we get that. And then there is a summation where mu takes the value 0, that gives us this term over here. Okay, and then we use the second structure equation, which allows us to identify that all of this is really just the spatial curvature form. All of this simply the spatial curvature form. So those two terms just give us the spatial curvature form. We have that. Therefore, we have the space-time curvature tensor, or space-time curvature two form, expressed in terms of just the spatial curvature two form, plus the affine connection between space and time. Remember that we already calculated omega bar. That was something we did at the very beginning. Remember, we assumed the full symmetry, concluded that r bar has to be some expression in terms of the metric and could only be this. Once we have that, we were able to calculate the spatial curvature proof form, because the spatial curvature proof form is nothing but the Riemann curvature tensor, where two indices that are anti-symmetric are declared to be part of the form. So if this is the three-mode curvature tensor, then by just contracting with the stretch product here, we obtain the curvature proof form. And the curvature proof form, using that, was simply this. Okay? So now we can go back and use this, right? Sorry, where?
With double derivatives of the metric.
I don't know what you mean. Did you see that anywhere in the slides there?
No, I mean the Riemann curvature tensor is double derivatives of the metric.
No, oh, the Christofferson. That's what I said. Okay, so where we are now is that the
we had expressed the space-time curvature tensor, curvature form, at least its spatial component, in this way, where this was the curvature form of just the spatial part. And that, we know what it is explicitly. It was k times this net product of the basis vector. But those guys are the same as the frame vectors in the full space time up to a scale factor a. Remember, that was the relationship between the triad and the tetrad. Those guys are up to a factor of 1 over a, the same as those. Mm. And the theta 0 was just dt. OK, so we can plug that into here. And then we obtain that the curvature proof form is, well, from here, we get k over a squared times that. That's this. And now, these things, we also know what they are. We calculated what omega I naught is. That was in the box up there. And if we plug in what we got, and if you remember, it was here. Omega I naught, a dot over a, theta I. We did it here. A dot over a squared, theta I, that's okay. Okay, so finally, you can put those guys on the same denominator here, and you obtain that the curvature proof form for such highly symmetric spacetime always takes this form, at least the spatial part of it. And then one can also calculate, and I leave it up to you to do that with your calculation, what the zero I component of it is, and that comes out like this. So now that we have the curvature proof form, we can calculate pretty much everything. The curvature proof form gives us, remember, the curvature proof form is given in those two boxes there, this and that. And once we have that, we can remember if, for example, you want to reconstruct now what the full Riemann curvature tensor is. You just have to remember that the curvature proof form is this, and you can read off from there what the individual coefficients are of the Riemann curvature tensor. And once we have that, we won't go into that in all detail. But once we have that, we can then obtain the Ricci tensor, and from there we can get the curvature scalar, for example. Of course, we could also just stay within the framework of the tetrad and then write down the Einstein equation for the tetrad. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, let's move back and forth between it. So given this information here, we can read off what the Riemann curvature tensor is, what the Ricci tensor is, and what the Ricci scalar is. And therefore, we can write down the Einstein equation. So this is the Einstein tensor, which we can now also calculate because we have the Ricci tensor and we have the Ricci scalar. And the result of that calculation is, and it's not very long because it's easy to read off those things, the result is that the Einstein tensor 0,0 component is this, and the II, the space component, looks like that, and it doesn't have off-diagonal terms. The Einstein tensor is purely diagonal. It has only two kinds of terms, the temporal term, the 0,0 term, this one, and the space component are those. The Einstein tensor is diagonal in this frame. And what about the energy momentum equation? So we have now the left hand side of the Einstein equation, the energy the Einstein equation. What about the right hand side? See, ultimately we are after calculating the scale factor, A of t. So that's the only thing that is still having a degree of freedom in all of this. Well, and k. But k is just fixed once and for all. But a is a function of t. It's how the space-time is expanding or contracting. That's what we are after. And we will get that out of the Einstein equation, actually. So the left-hand side we have to express ultimately in terms of A. Because we have it expressed in terms of things that depend on A. On this stuff. Function of A. Now, what about the right-hand side in the Einstein equation? Clearly, the energy momentum tensor better be diagonal, otherwise we don't have consistency with our answer. So this thing is diagonal, so the energy momentum tensor has to be diagonal as well, otherwise our answers of such high symmetry will fail. So we identify the diagonal entries, since the energy momentum tensor has to be diagonal, in order to be compatible with our answer, assumption. We can write the energy momentum tensor in this way, and we identify, of course, the zero-zero component again as the energy density, and those three components we will call the pressure, but keep in mind that the energy momentum here may be due not to a gas that has pressure. Instead, there may be no gas around at all. What may be the cause of this energy momentum tensor could be just quantum fields. Electromagnetic fields or whatnot. And they would all contribute here something, and its physical origin wouldn't be pressure, wouldn't be particles banging into another. And still, just for convenience, you will call whatever is over here pressure. Okay, so the energy momentum tensor will be of the form of an energy density and something else here from matter. And then also there could be a cosmological constant. And as is common nowadays, we will write the cosmological constant as part of the energy momentum tensor. Of course, the cosmological constant could be written on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, which is where Einstein first placed it. He viewed it as something that could be added to the Einstein tensor, which he didn't call Einstein. Anyway, I wonder what he called it. Anyway, so nowadays one views the cosmological constant's natural home to be the right-hand side of the equation. Doesn't matter at all, but we'll write it on the right-hand side. And so the energy momentum tensor consists of two contributions. There is the part, in principle, that corresponds to energy momentum, to energy from matter, generalized pressure that comes from matter or radiation, and the cosmological constant. But in fact, it's often the case where people would just bunch the two together and say the cosmological constant is part of this. We don't even separate whether the energy comes from matter, radiation, or cosmological constant. You know, whether the pressure is from matter or cosmological constant, we all bunch it together in one tensor and the exponential tensor. So the terminology is that the cosmological constant contributes negative energy density, contributes positively to the energy density because of the minus side here, but contributes negatively to the pressure.
Canonical coordinates again. So how can we replace the metric on the right-hand side with just the symmetric metric again? Because like typically you have the cosmological constant times the metric on the left-hand side, correct? Of the Einstein equation. So why can we have the Minkowski metric instead of the metric we defined previously?
You're right. In principle, you're right. Yes, I should have written
here lambda times the metric. That's what it is. And I was expecting that. Thanks for pointing that up. Yeah, but remember that the main conclusion in this business is the same, namely that the metric will be diagonal, it will have a negative component here, and it will have positive component over there. In fact, it will have a minus one over here, and it will have factors of A over there. And therefore, the functionality constant will contribute negatively to positively to the energy density and negatively to the pressure. Okay, so that means that well, our finding that the Einstein tensor is diagonal when we assume that much symmetry, namely isotropy and homogeneity, each state. The finding that the Einstein tensor is diagonal forced us to look for situations, but to look only for situations in which the energy momentum tensor is also diagonal. Otherwise, we wouldn't have considered. This highly symmetric situation can only arise if the energy momentum tensor is also diagonal. So it has to have that particular form here, which means that even though matter might do complicated things, ultimately it can only, the way it can influence space-time is only through the relationship between rho and p. Because we know that the energy momentum tensor has to have some component in the zero-zero, has something in the zero-zero slot, and it has the same thing in the II slot for each I. So therefore, whatever matter might be doing, as far as gravity is concerned, the only thing that gravity cares about concerning matter is the relationship between the energy and the pressure, where I've now already used the terminology which everything about the cosmological concept is already built into. We just look at the energy momentum tensor, and it contains everything. Stuff that comes from matter, stuff that comes from radiation, and stuff that comes from the cosmological constant. So therefore, the only non-trivial dynamic of matter, as far as gravity is concerned, is encoded in its equation of state, in the relationship between the energy density and the pressure. Or pressure as a function of the energy density. You see, this is something that really, that relationship between energy density and pressure is something that is characteristic for each type of matter that you might be looking at. If, for example, you have a gas, a hydrogen gas, for example, it will have some relationship between energy density and pressure. And then if you have a radiation gas, just a gas of photons, it will have another relationship between energy density and pressure. And if you have a box in which there is neither a regular gas nor a gas of photons, but just vacuum, then the vacuum too has some characteristic relationship between energy density and matter. And if you have a mixture in your box of a cosmological constant, that is to say a ground state energy, and you also have some gas, and you also have some radiation in there, then you will have some complicated equation of state. And if one of the components in the box is dominating, let's say there is far more radiation than anything else, then it's going to be mostly, it's very close to the equation of state for radiation. If matter dominates, the equation of state will be essentially that, as if there were only matter. The relationship between energy density and pressure is going to be as if there were. Now, since the energy momentum tensor has to have this simple form, it looks as if it were a perfect fluid. And remember that this is how we define in cosmology perfect fluid. A perfect fluid is any kind of matter that has a energy momentum tensor of a particularly simple form. Remember with this unit vector u. With a time-like velocity vector u. So why is that? Well, this for this time-like velocity vector u, we can use the vector dual to the theta naught. Theta naught was dt. The vector that u dual to is, we may call u, and it is d by dt. right? Obviously, I mean, that is the vector that is dual to dt. And since it's the dual vector to theta naught, we would normally write it as E naught. The EI or E mu being the basis vector of the tangent space, the theta being the basis vector of the potential space. Okay, so let us remember for now that we defined U to be d by dt. And then it turns out that this energy momentum tensor up there can be written in this way. The energy momentum tensor is rho plus t plus lambda bar, and lambda bar is the cosmic energy constant divided by 8 pi d. See, there was a factor of 8 pi d. Okay, so t mu nu is this expression plus that expression, and if you just look at what the metrics are with plus and minus sign, you will see that it's the energy momentum. So in practice, can we ever view this vector u as a velocity vector of some actual fluid? Turns out we can. I mean, it depends, of course, what the situation is. Let's see what the logic was. Logic was, we're looking at cosmological models that have full symmetry, spatial and translational symmetry. That forced us into having diagonal identity. That forced us in having a particular simple diagonal form of the energy momentum tensor. That meant that the energy momentum tensor had this form of a perfect fluid in which this mysterious vector u could be identified. Now, if we look at the universe as it is now, for example, not in the very early universe or early universe, but now, well, now it is basically a universe filled with dust, where the dust particles are galaxies. And then the u vector can be identified as the velocity vector, in fact, of those galaxies. Now, we are assuming here that the galaxies do not have peculiar velocity. They are not moving against another. All they do is they sit still, and space is expanding, and that's why the distance between them is increased. Of course, in reality, galaxies move towards another. They have what is called peculiar velocity. But in the overall scheme of things, it doesn't matter. Once you are looking at length scales of 2 or 3 billion light years, the motion, the speed with which galaxies are moving apart from another, is far greater than any peculiar velocity that they might have. So we can assume that, there is no peculiar velocity. So at the present, for example, our galaxy is a particle in that fluid or in that gas. I mean, fluids and gas being essentially the same thing to the degree. And u is our velocity vector. And we are moving only in time. The galaxy, if it's assumed not to have a peculiar velocity, the galaxy is moving, of course, but only moving in time. Its four velocity vector only has a component in the time direction, not in the space direction. That's why u, as a tangent vector, is d by dt, and has no d by dx component in it. It's only pointing in the time direction, not in any space direction. And indeed, u is tangent to time-like geodesics. Right? So this is, to make it precise, what I said in words, namely that this vector u is tangent to time-like geodesics. So our galaxy is moving along in a time-like geodesic. Time-like because it has mass. It cannot travel space-like or light-like. So it's traveling time-like. And it's on a geodesic because our galaxy doesn't have a jet engine that would accelerate it, right? So it's just floating on a geodesic. Okay, so our galaxy is moving on a time-like geodesic. And u is indeed a tangent to time-like geodesic. As we can see here, we calculate the covariant derivative of u in the direction of u, and we're really calculating the covariant derivative of e naught in the direction of e naught. But that we can work out using the affine connection one form, like that. And we know what the affine connection one form values are for u zero component.
Well, we didn't say that. It's true that it is, but why would we didn't need that?
No, you say that U is perpendicular to ER.
Yeah,
if
defined it as being E zero.
It's E zero, and they form a
frame. Well, you defined it that way, but why should it be defined?
But we defined it that way, and then we showed the properties of it. See, we defined it this way, and we showed that if we define this thing, then the energy momentum tensor above can be written in this form.
We need not define it that way.
No, but then we wouldn't have the benefit of being able to show its properties.
No, but how do you justify defining it that way?
Definitions never need to be justified. Only propositions need to be justified. Propositions need to be proven, but definitions are just giving names to things. Basically, you could say this thing gets a new name, we call it U. Okay?
But why should U just be dy/dt?
It's a definition. Just a definition. Please just take it as a definition. But you see, what we can prove for this definition is that if we calculate the covariant derivative of the unit direction of U, then that is zero. If we work it out, and we get, we know what the affine connection one form is. We work it out three sides back. It doesn't have a zero zero component. The I zero component is given by that. And then you see, the fact that it doesn't have a zero zero component means that we have to evaluate the connection one form I zero component, which is theta I, on internaut, but since they are dual bases, that gives us a zero. So that's just making precise what I said in so many words. Okay, so finally now, we have everything together. We have some information about the energy momentum tensor, and we have some information, or enough information about the Einstein tensor, and we can put it all together. We have then that the remember that the Einstein tensor had a zero zero component, and it had II component. It had nothing off diagonal, and all the II components are of the same form. So the zero zero component of the Einstein equation gives us that equation here. Notice that we have to the energy density, and the space component. Space component of the Einstein equation gives us that equation here. Notice that we have the pressure. Now this first equation is the Friedmann equation. The second one doesn't have any particular name. So what we will do in the rest of this lecture now is to solve those equations here, because this is the complete set of Einstein equations. In principle, of course, that's a bunch of more equations than this. But because of the high symmetry that we assumed, there was only one free parameter really, one free continuous parameter, and that was A of t. On top of that, we had one discrete parameter, the k, which could be plus or minus 1 or 0. So we are now trying to find A of t. First of all, we notice that both equations contain a term k over a squared. Sorry that this is so small, it's hard to read. But that's k over a squared, and that's k over a squared. And that is very convenient because it means that we can get rid of those terms simply by subtracting the two equations from another, and or adding in this case. And in this way, we are getting rid of this unknown k. We end up with an equation that doesn't depend on whether the universe has positive, negative, or no curvature. So here's the same thing, k over a squared occurs in both Einstein equations, a and b, a being the Friedmann equation, and b. So if we add the two equations there, we obtain this equation. Basically, that's just the sum of the two Einstein equations. No k in this, so this is true no matter whether the universe has positive, negative, or no curvature, which is very nice because you don't want to have to make an assumption about this just yet, especially because experimentally it's not so clear what it is.
Now, from this equation, we can read off some immediate, very important consequences. Namely, first of all, if the cosmological constant is zero, then we must have deceleration. We must have the A double dot. The scale factor must decelerate. So the universe might be expanding fast, but the expansion has to slow down. See, the larger A dot is, the faster the universe is expanding. A is a static scale factor, A dot is the expansion rate, A double dot is the acceleration or deceleration of the expansion. So up until about 10 years ago, the idea was that the cosmological constant is zero. Therefore, while the universe is expanding now, it was expected that the expansion is slowing down. And what was usually taught in courses like this course is that there is a nice coincidence. Namely, there are three possibilities for how fast this would slow down, assuming that the cosmological constant is absent, right? So 10 years ago, I would have said the following. This is zero. This is slowing down. And then you could ask, well, what are the possibilities? It could be that the universe comes to a screeching halt and then waits a moment, just like in a cartoon, and then it would all recollapse and end up in a big crunch at the end. That's one possibility. But it could also be that the velocity with which the universe is expanding, the rate at which it is expanding, is exceeding its escape velocity, and it just keeps on expanding forever. That's another possibility. And mathematically, it is allowed in the equation. It's not obvious, but it is allowed. That is a possibility. Or it could be just critical. It could be that the universe is expanding, the expansion rate goes down, but never quite reaches zero. It's only asymptotic to zero. So the universe wouldn't come to a standstill and then recollapse. It just would asymptotically slow down until eventually, you know, things are basically at rest, but so far apart that they don't pull themselves together. And then the amazing observation was that mathematically, in the absence of a cosmological constant, those three cases, recollapse, going on forever, or critical in the middle, correspond exactly to the cases k smaller than 0, k equals 0, k larger than 0. If the universe is spatially finite in the absence of a cosmological constant, if the universe is spatially finite, if it is a sphere, if we have positive curvature, then it would expand for a while, but come to a halt, and then recollapse and end in a big crunch. If the universe had a hyperbolic geometry with a negative curvature, then it would go on forever, and the k equals 0 case would be just the threshold. So until about 10 years ago, the idea was that since space is observed to be pretty flat, we have not only that space seems to be very flat, and we are close to k equals 0, of all values that k could have, it's apparently close to 0, but also that meant, at the time at least, that meant that the universe is going to expand forever, but at a rate that approaches zero. For some strange reason, that would have been the case, and that would have been some fine-tuning. Anyway, now we don't believe anymore that there is no cosmological constant, and the relationship between k being smaller zero, equals zero, or positive is no longer tied to the universe recollapsing or not recollapsing, as you will see. I'm just saying that because if you look at old textbooks or old papers, they might come up with arguments like that if they disregarded the cosmological constant. Okay, so what we see here is that if there's no cosmological constant, then the universe has to decelerate. Whether it decelerates enough to recollapse or not is a different story, but it will have to decelerate. But then enters the cosmological constant. See, the cosmological constant can completely change the whole behavior. And that's because it's positive. it contributes towards an acceleration of the universe. Now you might think, well, but what if it's small? You can forget about it, right? The thing is, this is a constant, just a number, okay? So that stuff is dynamical. And if the universe expands, the energy density must drop. Because matter will get diluted. Energy density must drop, and so must the pressure. Therefore, those guys will eventually go arbitrarily small, leaving the stage for this thing to act. Okay? And apparently, this is exactly what's happening nowadays. It seems that we live in an epoch in the universe in which those things have become so small that they are now smaller than that contribution. So that now the universe has, recently, like 2-3 billion years ago, the universe stopped decelerating, and apparently it started to accelerate because of that term over there. Anyway, we'll get to that some more later. Okay, so what is the experimental evidence? Supernova distance versus brightness data and evidence from the cosmic background radiation tell us that A double dot is apparently larger than zero. At present, the energy is already, well, that is to say the matter and energy, radiation, is already sufficiently diluted so that the cosmological constant already dominates over the energy and the pressure. And the balance seems to be now that of all the energy in the energy momentum center, 70% is already due to the cosmological constant, and only 30% is due to matter. And in fact, of those 30% of the energy density in the energy momentum center that is due to matter, only about a tenth of that, or 3% overall, is due to visible matter that we know of. And the rest is apparently due to dark matter that we can only infer through its gravitational action. And by the way, in this business here, nowadays we can omit that term heat, the pressure, because if you view the universe as a gas as dust of galaxies, then those galaxies certainly have energy density, but they don't have pressure. They're just pressureless gas. All right, so in the far future, energy density and pressure will have diluted towards zero, leaving only the cosmological constant. And in fact, once this process has started, and it has started apparently, this is going to be a runaway thing. Because the faster it expands, the quicker rho and phi dilute, and the more lambda will dominate. So at the moment, this is how it looks. So then, after a while, give it a few more billion years, I don't know, 10, 20 billion years or so, then really lambda is completely dominating the scenery, and the equation above, the Friedmann equation, the Friedmann equation looks like that. It has just the lambda on the right hand side. Let me just show you the Friedmann equation again. Here we go, that's the Friedmann equation. This dot equals 2 lambda, because the energy density has gone away. So what does that mean? Here we go. Here's the Friedmann equation. We can solve that for the three cases. K equal to 1, K equal to 0, K equal to minus 1. Now, similarly to the analysis that I mentioned, if there is no cosmological, then spatial closure of the universe also means that it's temporarily closed, because it goes on to expand only for a finite amount of time and then it recollapses. And if it's spatially infinite, then it's also infinite in time. A similar analysis we can now do on the other end of the spectrum, where we say there is a cosmological constant. In fact, there's only a cosmological constant, and the rest can be detected. In that case, the situation looks like this. This is the Friedmann equation, and it can be solved by those functions. These are the solutions for the three cases of k equal plus 1, 0, or minus 1. The hyperbolic cosine, exponential, and hyperbolic sine. And if you know the hyperbolic cosine, hyperbolic sine, you know that for large arguments, for large t, for late time, they all behave exponentially. So this means that the universe is going to be exponentially expanding no matter what. If the cosmological constant dominates, the universe will expand exponentially no matter whether it is spatially closed or not. So you can now have a situation where the universe is spatially closed, k equal 1. It would be just a sphere, a three-dimensional sphere, though. And yet, and that sphere would be expanding over time, but without end. In fact, acceleratingly so. And that means we would have something like a big rift, even though there is something more severe than that also in the cards. And I will get to that. No, that energy, setting the k equal what, plus or minus 1 or 0. I mean, let's solve one case. Let's say k is equal to 0. This term drops out, and then what we have is that a dot squared over a squared is equal to a third of lambda. Okay? Now, what is that? It's a dot equal to 1 over square root of 3 times lambda times a. Solution is exponential. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because they look a bit very...
No, it's fine.
Okay.
It's
fine. Just check.
But you're welcome to check that, of course.
Thank you.
You see, the thing is that it has unique solutions. This thing, these are the unique solutions. And if those solutions were not also solving the space-space equation of the Einstein equation, then it would mean the Einstein equation doesn't have a solution. Doesn't have at all. And we can show on general grounds that it has solutions, and therefore it often suffices to just solve one solution, it will take care of the others as well. If what you solve for is already unique, as it is in this case. But you're right, in principle, that's something to worry about, and you have to check that. Okay, now, this was the special case where we had only cosmological constant, and that may be in our future. Now, let's look at the case where we have a cosmological constant and matter. Then, what is the general strategy in this? Well, we have three unknown functions of time that need to be determined. The scale factor, well, but also the energy density as a function of time, the pressure as a function of time. And you see they're interdependent. Obviously, the energy density as a function of time depends on how much expansion we have. And how much expansion we're going to have depends on how much energy density there is. And similarly, the pressure plays a role in this. So they are really three coupled functions that need to be solved. But fortunately, we do have three equations for that. Namely, in general, we will have the two Einstein equations, A and B, both of them. And we have an equation of state. Depending on what the matter in question is, radiation, some dust, or not, it will have some relationship between the pressure and the energy density. And that's really just a regular regular physics that could be done in the lab for any. You fill a box with something, and then you check how the energy relates to the pressure. So in particular, the three cases that are of most relevance in cosmology, because they occur at different epochs in the history of the universe, are the case of pure vacuum energy that we just discussed, where the pressure is the negative of the energy density. And that is what applies to the very early universe. Then we have the case where the pressure is a third of the energy density. And that is what comes out of the Maxwell equation. And that applies, for example, for the early universe, not for the very early universe of the first and second, but for the early universe, for the first few 100,000 years or so, for the first 100,000 years or so, we can assume that it was basically pure radiation. It was so hot that the radiation dominated over the matter. And in that epoch, we had that the pressure is a third of the energy density, which doesn't come from the action equations, but it's something about the physics of gases, of radiation gases. And I think we actually calculated that for the Maxwell equations way back when we wrote down the energy momentum tensor for the Maxwell equations, we were able to read off this factor of a third. Well, and then there's the case of pure dust, where the pressure, no matter what the energy density is zero. The galaxy gas doesn't have, the gas of galaxies doesn't have pressure. And that would be a pretty good description of the universe today. Now, a very useful observation is that equation A above, the first of the Einstein equations, namely the Friedmann equation, only contains A, the scale factor, and the energy density, but it doesn't contain the pressure. So this leads us to the following idea. Let us try to express the energy density as a function of the scale factor. Let us try to somehow relate rho and A by other means, by means other than the Friedmann equation. If we can do this, then we can plug that into the Friedmann equation and solve for A alone, or solve for rho alone. And so we are starting to unravel the whole thing because we obtain A, and then rho, and then P. So if we manage somehow to relate the energy density to the scale factor, then we can put this relation, energy density as a function of the scale factor, into the Friedmann equation, which then becomes an equation of only A, or only rho. And that's just an ordinary differential equation of, let's say, only A as a function of time. And that differential equation can be solved, and in this instance we have the whole thing. But what we have to do in order for this strategy to work is find out what is rho as a function of A. Now here's the key ingredient that helps us to find rho as a function of A. Intuitively, we should be able to find rho as a function of A, because the energy density clearly has to be diluted as the universe expands, right? So all what this expresses is how the energy dilutes as the universe expands, rho of A. And somehow we should be able to get this. Here's a very useful proposition for this purpose, namely that the Einstein equations A and B, where A and B imply that. And this is a very important equation, equation P. This is a very important equation, which will do the job of relating for us rho to A. And it has exactly this physical meaning that we were looking for. It tells us how energy dilutes. And to see that, look at what it means. This is just the energy in the Kolmogorov volume. This is just the energy density times a volume that is increasing in time as the scale factors increase. So this is just the energy in a particular volume. And as the universe expands, we calculate the rate with which the energy in that is changing. And it says it is 3 times p a squared. This equation, if you are, at least if you're coming from physics rather than math, you've already seen in a way, not in this formulation, but you've seen an equation like that, because it's simply adiabatic expansion of the gas. And as I will show in a moment, but for now, let's see, let's just take this for granted. I will show you in a moment why intuitively it ought to be true, and then I'll show you why really it is true by proving. But for now, let's just take it as it is, and let's see whether it really helps. What we want to do is express rho as a function of A, and plug them into the Friedman effect. Does this thing help in that purpose, for that purpose? Let's see. Well, let us assume that we know that the equation of state parameter W. Remember, the relationship between pressure and energy density is the so-called equation of state. And in many circumstances, there's a linear relationship between pressure and energy density. This is the case for a box full of gas. It's true for a box full of radiation. And it's true for a box that is empty, just like in any. OK, so let us assume that we know what that value of W is. And it's for dust, for example, the pressure is equal to 0, so W is equal to 0. For radiation, the pressure is a third of the energy density, as we just discussed. And so W is a third. And for pure energy, for pure vacuum, pure cosmological constant, the pressure is minus the energy density. Then in those three cases, P can dissolve. You see, if we can express P as a multiple of rho, then this equation here can be solved. We can find what rho is as a function of A. At the moment, this equation contains rho, A, and P. But if we assume that we know how to express P in terms of rho, then we can solve this differential equation here to obtain rho as a function of A, which is exactly what we want. That is what we want to plug into the Friedman effect. So what do we get, for example, for P equals 0? For P equals 0, the right-hand side is 0, and we have to solve that equation. It is solved, obviously, in the case for rho being proportional to A to the power of minus 3. Because if rho is A to the power of minus 3, the whole thing is a constant, and its derivative is 0, which is what it ought to be. We assume the right-hand side is 0 because P is 0. Similarly, in the case of radiation, we obtain that rho as a function of A goes like minus the fourth power. And in the case of pure cosmological constant, we find that rho is a constant. Please check it. It's a simpler thing to do. Maybe a little comment. What we find here is that in the case of dust, like just particles, pressureless dust expanding, we find that the energy dilutes, the energy density dilutes as A to the minus 3, which is completely what we would expect, because the particles themselves dilute like A to the power minus 3. They dilute like 1 over the volume. And the only energy is in their rest energy, in their mc squared. So as the particles dilute, so does the energy density. Therefore, that's absolutely plausible. For radiation, however, we find that its energy density dilutes faster than 1 over the volume. Do you know why that would be so? Any one of you heard why that is so? Why the energy density of a gas of radiation drops faster with the increase in volume than the energy density of matter? Well, it is because if you think of radiation as consisting of photons, then those photons surely get diluted as you increase the volume. Just the number density goes down, like A to the third power. But on top of that, you can view them as representing waves. And those waves get the redshifted. And the redshift gives an extra factor of A in the denominator. Because the wavelength gets stretched along with the wave. Along with space, the wavelength gets stretched. But the wavelength is proportional to the energy. It's inversely proportional to the energy. And therefore, the energy drops not just by A to the minus third power, but because of the redshift, by A to the minus fourth power. I think that's an easy memory device to remember how that relationship works for matter and how it goes for radiation. And we notice that this equation tells us that the energy density in the case of the presence of only a cosmological constant is constant. We shouldn't be surprised by the fact that vacuum energy doesn't get diluted, because the cosmological constant is constant, right? It's a constant. So the energy density, density is not only constant in space, it's also constant in time. Because the lambda just doesn't depend on either space or time. Okay, so what is the intuitive meaning? I said that we would, it just shows that equation V is going to solve our problem. Because we can now get rho as a function of A in the three scenarios, in the three epochs that we're most interested in. We can plug that into the Friedman equation, which is an equation between only rho and A, and out of that we will get A as a function of time. Now the next thing is, what is the intuitive meaning of P? Well, P, this equation P, is the general relativity version of the continuity equation for adiabatic expansion. Now this, the physicist around here would have seen before, dE is minus pdV. When you pump up your bicycle, for example, you have that. It's adiabatic expansion. It's an expansion or contraction of the gas, which happens so fast that there is no significant exchange of energy with the environment. Then you have that. And obviously, the universe is not going to exchange energy with an environment of other universes or something. So it's possible. This is just a possibility argument, not a proof. So we know that this holds in ordinary physics. Now, if we simply set the volume here to be a to the third power, scale factor to the third power, the energy to be the energy density times the volume, well, then this equation becomes that equation, but this means we have d of a to the third power is 3pa squared dA, and therefore we get this equation, which is indeed our equation P. So really what this equation P out there says is, in effect we have what would, from ordinary physics, be called adiabatic expansion. But we still have to prove equation P, and let's not go through the details because we are out of time for that. Let me just sketch how that works. We know that equations A and B, and the Einstein equations imply that the covariant trace of, not the trace, T mu nu, semicolon mu equal to zero, which is not a conservation law, but it's an important equation. And the energy momentum tensor in our case is this one. Therefore, its covariant, the vanishing of its covariant derivative is this expression here. We use Leibniz rule. We do some straightforward manipulations. And we end up with this equation here, where u, remember, is d by dt. Now we calculate du, this expression here. Del u is u mu semicolon mu. That's just a shorthand notation for u up mu semicolon. We calculate that. Lots of straightforward calculations that are perhaps of interest to you because they are exercising the technology of the tetrit formalism. I tried to put in there a lot of comments that indicate what exactly you're using in each step. So you should be able to follow those things, but let me know if you need some of that. And so at the end of the day, there's no extra ingredient needed, and we can derive this equation P here, which is the one we need. Let me just close this session by this lecture by saying that when this equation, it's an equation that relates rho to A, and in the three scenarios that we are most interested in, dust, radiation, and post-natural constant only, we can solve this thing and obtain rho as a function of A. This goes into the Friedman equation, and then we get an equation, the Friedman equation turns into an equation, a differential equation for only A. That we can solve, and then we see how the universe is going, how it is expanding, contracting, all of that. Okay, I think we should have a break now, let's say 5 to 10 minutes. Get rid of those donuts, and then we'll be complete.